We're gonna continue with our program. I am very pleased to introduce you to Professor Gordon Hickey, who's a professor in natural resource sciences in the McDonald campus. And he has happily and kindly agreed to chair the next session. We'll continue with the discussion on current and future challenges for sustainable food security, in this case in industrialized countries. Gordon, thank you very much, and thank you so much to the panelists as well. Please.
Thank you, Hugo. Good morning, everyone. The title of this session is Current and Future Challenges for Sustainable Food Security in Industrialized Countries. And I have a policy, an interest and a specialty in policy and governance, and the previous questions raised a lot of issues that are actually sustainability issues, and I heard the word sustainability used many times. Without going into a lecture on sustainability and boring you, when we think about sustainability, we can think of three things. We can think about intergenerational equity, how we, within our own generation, take care of and think about others within our generation. And when we say equity, we think of questions of fairness. So we're thinking of, it could be rural-urban, it could be indigenous peoples, non-indigenous peoples, it could be people in industrialized countries and non-industrialized countries. There's also intergenerational, when we think about making decisions and thinking about the various ways in which we can minimize impacts or provide future opportunities for our children's children and so forth. And then there's the conservation of biodiversity, which I often think of as sort of interspecies equity, what's fair for other species. So as we think about these questions today in the context of industrialized countries, I think we need to also recognize that sustainability and the various issues facing industrialized countries will have impacts on non-industrialized or developing countries and vice versa. And so when you think about your questions for our panel, I urge you to think about the sort of integrative nature of food systems, the complex challenges we face as policymakers and people seeking to inform decision making, right from the farmer to the international community levels. We have a very interesting panel of speakers that have very different backgrounds, and they're going to present their view on what some of the main challenges are facing countries such as Canada and beyond in the context of food security and natural resource management. Our first speaker is Valerie Sapin. She's an academic associate who's just joined our Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences, and she's come to us from Australia, I was just finding out, so nice to have another Australian around. And she is going to talk to us based on and share some of her experiences working in a range of different contexts and experiencing the various challenges facing farming systems, innovation, agribusiness, technology, and communities in that context and reflect on ways forward. So Valerie, would you come to the stage?
Good morning, everybody, and thank you, Hugo, for the opportunity. I'm very new to McGill, only a month and a half. I am French and Australian, so some people... Yes, thank you. Some people think I'm more Australian than French. I've spent a lot of time overseas. My background is an extension worker. I started in the Congo working with women on cassava, and with young producers also on vegetable production. I worked in Gabon on peri-urban irrigation with women to help them access land. I've worked in Vietnam managing a microcredit scheme for women. I've worked in Europe in the intensive poultry and pork industry, and in Australia in the Queensland area with crop growers. My last position was managing a large database and fostering dialogue on the protection of the Great Barrier Reef. So my head is in both context, and I've joined McGill to develop international projects in Africa with Chandra, and also to develop agribusiness and entrepreneurship, a new course that is offered in January with Eduardo here. Hugo asked me to talk about some social impacts, and you've heard a lot of concepts. So My talk is going to maybe try to illustrate some of the concepts, and I want to stress that what's been presented in terms of the challenges for developing countries do exist in industrial countries. There's a lot of parallel. The outline is very simple. I'm going to present some major trends, some you know already, some that are emerging, the impacts that I've seen on local communities and farmers here, some of the implications and conclusions. Just to put it in context, you can see here, in Canada, agriculture represents around $106 billion, employs over 2 million people, and there's potential to create another 74,000 jobs by 2022. The concern a few years ago, and the concern is still present, is that a lot of these jobs may not be filled. So why is there an issue with labour in general in agriculture? You know that our food systems, we all want cheap food, and that has created low farmer returns in some areas, and as a result they can't pay themselves a wage, so they pay very low wages to their own labour. And that goes down the whole value chain that was discussed. In Europe, you saw this year pork producers in the streets in France, and it's the whole value chain. It's the people working in abattoirs, it's the truck drivers from Eastern Europe, it's the tomatoes in the French supermarkets that come from Spain, and it's actually illegal migrants working in very bad conditions producing those tomatoes. So that's on one hand. On the other, farmers are finding it hard in Canada and elsewhere, it's the same in Australia, to access labour because nobody wants to come and work for those wages. Difficult to access land because of the issues mentioned early on. In Australia, we don't have quotas, but we've got water rights, and it's very difficult to access water as well, not to mention finance. Another big aspect, and it's happening in many industries, not just agriculture, we're seeing a concentration of power in and technology and science in a smaller number of companies. And so they have the chemistry, they have the IP, they have the technology and molecules. And like in the automobile sector, there's less and less brands and companies. It's the same in agriculture. And one that is emerging is a concentration of power in terms of who's got the big data or the power to manage big data. And one example of that is and I'm not against Monsanto. I've got friends working with Monsanto, but they invested nearly $1 billion in a company called Climate Corp 2 years ago. Climate Corp just aggregates a lot of scientific data and links it with weather, and it's a huge platform, and that gives you access to a lot of information. On a positive side, compared to a few years ago, there's a lot of investments in agriculture. And I've been following from here the investments from venture capitalists. And last year and this year, it's still on the increase. There's more money invested in agriculture technology, biotech and ag tech, than there is in clean technology. That is from private investors who are looking for future returns and see huge potential in that market. So that is fostering a lot of innovation and funding a lot of startups. And for those interested, there's a website I've put here called Ag Funder. It's an online financing platform that brings big money and startups there. And there's a lot of interesting developments there for those interested. The land grabs that were mentioned represent around $11 billion. PE here means private equity, and it's not just land, it's the buying of food processing plants overseas or plantations. And those land grabs also exist in Australia, and actually La Caisse des dépôts du Canada, which is a retirement fund for Canadian people, is investing in Australia as well. So just a few examples that I want to bring to your attention here. Local food is one of the movements that we've seen. In Canada, our local food production relies on 40,000 international mobile workers from South America, Guatemala, Mexico, and the Caribbean. So while we're happy that we're minimizing the local footprint of food, we're actually moving 40,000 single people who are away from their families 8 months of the year. And although the government and farmers are doing their utmost to house them properly and look after them, some of these people do suffer from social isolation and poor housing conditions and no access to benefits or health. So the harvest is finished. There's 450 leaving tomorrow from the airport from Quebec. It's a question. I think it's a good thing to know, but it's a bit of a blind spot of the local food movement. And for those interested, I can refer you to the work of Dr. Carrie Priebusch from the Guelph University. I thought it was a very interesting concept. Just food for thought on the local apples. I know those come from the McDonald farm, but just bear a thought for the people who are harvesting your apples here locally. Okay. I'm going to move a bit quicker. I want to give you an example of what happens in Australia. In Queensland, the horticulture sector also relies on migrant labour or backpackers, so that's young people travelling to harvest. The horticulture sector, like here, is subject to contracts with big supermarkets. We only have two or three in Australia, Woolworths and Coles. So when you don't have access to that labour easily, and when you have to rely just on a limited number of contracts like here, what happens is you have a lot of waste and people go out of returns. The impact it has had and is that some farmers have completely changed their production systems to become more, I would say, reliant and not depend on labour. They've gone for macadamia nut plantations. Macadamia is a native from Australia. So it means that they've had to change their system because of labour or contract issues. Another social aspect of technology and social values and the use of technology in Australia, and it's something that's really was hard for me as an extension officer and for my colleagues. We worked for years to help farmers look after their soil and make money out of very fertile areas. Australia doesn't have many fertile areas. And during the mining boom, suddenly the mines came and bought out people, and they just turned up on farms, sometimes started doing surveys without even saying hi. And we saw for the first time something positive. We saw environmentalists and farmers together, which is pretty rare. And social media helped them do that. And there was a campaign called Lock the Gate, which still exists. And it put the onus back on the government to decide whether they wanted arable land and food for breakfast or coal for breakfast. The issue is still an issue in Australia where we can mine. We need mines, we need some of the income, but please don't put it on the most fertile areas next to population and where we produce food. I'll move a bit, and I won't go into the urban farm context. Just to say that I find our young people today, young farmers, it's not that they're not attracted to food production. They can't access the land, and some of them are looking on how to become urban producers. And it's hard. It's not easy. Some of them are doing it out of very innovative context in shipping containers or the loofah farms or the urban farms. But they have to be very creative in the new systems and food production systems that they're forced into in some ways. So technology is helping them, but they've still got some challenges. There's a lot of competition in that field, especially in the field of vertical urban farms. It's huge, and in the future, supermarkets could be producing their own vegetables on their own premises with the same technology. So I won't go into all the aspects other than some of these big food supermarket vertical farms are interestingly saying that in Singapore, for example, they can have senior people working in those farms. And in America, one of the new hydroponic farms, were saying also they're having disabled people in and helping them with labour. And so that's some of the developments. One of my last point is the concerns over the use of data. For me, private ownership and was a very fuzzy term until I had to manage a big database with farmers in Australia. And the technology is so developed now that we can tell where salinity is, which farms are polluting in the streams, which farms are eroded. And when you produce a map like that, you can compromise somebody's land value overnight. You can turn their reputation as a poor steward of the land. I worked for the Department of Primary Industries, and when we produced salinity maps, there was an uproar because they were very precise. We can do the same with nitrates. We can do the same with pesticides. We know who is polluting. So it's got a positive that you can tell somebody, listen, we know that comes from your farm. We can do that in a safe environment, and they change their practices. But if you put that in the public arena, you can damage somebody badly. And believe it or not, the first people who looked at those maps were sometimes sovereign funds to look at the fertility and the yield potential of those farms and to buy them. So be careful with data. There are values to honour there in terms of ethics, and there's some things that we can only learn on the way. We won't have all the answers. But I can tell you we had the first geo-reference database in Australia. And we worked with unions and community groups, and we did find solutions. We only published aggregated data, and on the ground with extension officers, we worked to change the practices. So it's not all negative. Another issue is that a lot of software decision tools were developed with farmers' IP. I worked with a lot of farmers, and all their yields were put in that. And then they resented having to buy it back from commercial firms. So a lot of the data that you're collecting from people, often it goes up in the air and they have to pay back to have it. So be conscious of that as well. So on that note, just to show you and illustrate, it's very easy now with telemetry to have automatic logging stations, and you can know live where things are happening. You can produce maps. And that can be used for the good of people. But just as an illustration of what I was saying, these are in riverbeds to look at the sediments coming from grazing properties. And this person here is used to be the president of WWF Australia. This person is used to be the president of the unions, soil scientist, very well known. And this lady there was the owner. And she saw us and... unbeknown to us, she was actually an attorney working on patent office in Sydney. And she said, that is my data that is going for public use. And that's where I realised, you know, how they wanted to help the science, and they knew the value of all those tools, but she was very concerned about where that data could go. And you can see that this is in a macadamia plantation. We have enough tools and technology now to be able, you know, to tell even during a storm, a few hours later, where all the nitrates, the pesticides are. Okay, so impact of technology, like everything in life, there's a yin and yang. And we just need to be aware of it. We don't have all the answers. But as an extension officer, and I agree with a lot of what was said this morning, our roles, it will often be to facilitate a dialogue. There's an over-investment in agriculture data. You have to help people understand it and make use of it. And our first and guest lecturer yesterday was saying, keep it simple sometime. I have two things I'm proud of in my career. One as an extension officer working with women in the pork or poultry industry is having people being able to exchange information on their respective contracts. Sometimes all you're doing is helping them and empower them with their own respective buyers. The second is helping women understand and use spreadsheets, Excel. And I did a lot of that, and a lot of women just, it changed their life because they could go to the bank with a budget. And in Australia, like in Africa, not a lot of women are on the land titles. And divorce is a big issue. But helping these women just know how to do an Excel spreadsheet made a big difference in their contribution and their ability as farmers as well. So just keep it simple. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a fascinating presentation that raised a lot of issues that relate to sustainability and integrate a lot of different challenges that we're facing in agriculture, both in developed areas but also in developing areas. The recurring issue of gender is important to highlight and I think underscore in this conference. The gender equity, what that means, how to facilitate it, and how to sort of benefit from it, I think are sort of the core challenges facing agriculture in many, many contexts.